Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Let me begin, as we always have to these days, by suggesting that if you have one of these in your pocket or your purse or under your seat, you might want to check it to make sure it's set to vibrate. Good afternoon to you all, and welcome to this afternoon's faculty symposium. My name is Tim Austin, and I'm the Vice President for Academic Affairs and Dean of the College. Today it is my great privilege to open this inauguration faculty symposium with a few words of congratulation to Father Burroughs on his imminent installation as our 32nd president, and then to outline for you the structure of this afternoon's event. Some years ago, ABC anchor Ted Koppel gave the commencement address at our Jesuit sister school, Loyola University Chicago. As is the custom at Loyola, he began his remarks with the words, "Reverend President," but then paused with an amused expression and commented, "What a title that is, Reverend President, the perfect synthesis of the sacred and the profane." At Holy Cross, Father, you will not often hear yourself addressed as Reverend President, though I have been known to default to it on some formal occasions. And yet, arguably, it has a greater meaning here than on many other Catholic campuses, distilling, as it does, an important insight into who we are and what we do here. In a book that I know you are familiar with, Father, I recently encountered the factoid that, quote, "The nation's liberal arts college students would almost certainly easily fit inside a Big Ten football stadium, since they number fewer than 100,000, end quote. This led me to reflect that the same was true of the undergraduate populations of the 28 Jesuit colleges and universities in the United States. So bear with me, please, while I indulge in a short flight of fancy. It is, I assure you, relevant to the theme of this symposium. Let us imagine that I have suddenly become fabulously wealthy, wealthy enough to be able to indulge the most eccentric and outrageous whims. I decide to organize two free blockbuster events. You can think of these events any way you like, rock concerts, sporting events, political rallies, but they have to be massive, and they have to appeal outrageously to women and men in the 18 to 22 demographic. So, I rent the University of Michigan Stadium, which Wikipedia tells me seats 109,000 spectators, and I rent it for an entire day. I schedule one of my extravaganzas in the afternoon, and I invite every student currently enrolled in a liberal arts college anywhere in the United States, all expenses paid, including charter flights and unlimited pizza and soda. I schedule the other event for the evening, and to this one I invite every undergraduate currently enrolled at a Jesuit institution, same terms. Then I sit back and I wait for the big day. The weather is fine, the first event in my double header, the one for liberal arts college students, is a sellout and wildly successful. As it winds down, the PA announces velvet-toned voice wishes the crowd safe travels home and the stadium empties out. But not entirely. In this massive stadium, a tiny group, numbering less than 3,000 souls, remain in their seats because they also hold tickets to the second event. They are, of course, Holy Cross students. I apologize if this dramatization veered a little too close to the melodramatic, but my hope was that it might help us all to grasp more intuitively the simple fact that the small college whose direction the trustees have entrusted into your capable hands, Father Burroughs, occupies a doubly exceptional position in the sometimes dizzyingly expansive universe of higher education. Whether viewed as a highly selective liberal arts college, or as an institution that carries forward the 450-year tradition of Jesuit education, Holy Cross stands apart from its peers. Or to put the same point more positively and in words made famous by the late Father John Brooks, Holy Cross aspires to bring together the best of both the spheres to which it belongs by being, quote, the Catholic Amherst. As faculty members, staff, and administrators in the Division of Academic Affairs, the women and men in this room recognize that you are assuming the leadership of this remarkable institution at a time when both of the communities in which we claim membership and also, I hope, exert leadership are under great pressure. On the one hand, the three P's, politicians, parents, and pundits, have the nation's liberal arts colleges squarely in their sights for what they see, wrongly in my view, as excessive cost and elitism in the worst sense of that word. On the other, many are questioning how schools in the Jesuit tradition can continue to live into that aspect of their identity as the number of Jesuits active on our campuses continues to shrink. Tough times indeed in which to accept the presidency of a school that must grapple with both sets of issues. This makes it all the more important that you should appreciate that the faculty, staff, and administrators gathered here, as well as their colleagues who are unable to join us for this symposium, offer you our support and our encouragement as you set about the tasks that lie ahead. In the past 8 months, you have shown yourself to be a careful listener, reflective and respectful of dissenting positions. You have learned quickly about a school that differs in some important ways from those you have worked at in the past, and you've indicated your willingness to learn more. You have shown the ability to act decisively when decisiveness was called for, and the capacity to delegate where that was more appropriate. And above all, you have demonstrated a personal warmth and compassion that has already earned you loyalty in many, many quarters. Protecting, preserving, and nourishing this remarkable institution in today's combative context will not be easy. Leading it to new heights will require a wide range of skills, great insight, dedication, and persistence. But many of those in this room this afternoon have championed the College of the Holy Cross through similarly challenging times, and they and their younger colleagues look forward to working beside you to achieve the goals we ultimately share. This afternoon's symposium has been designed as an extended conversation around this very topic, the special nature of the education we offer students here on Mount St. James. We will begin by hearing from six panelists. Three of them are Holy Cross faculty members whom the Inauguration Symposium Committee asked to prepare short presentations summarizing their thoughts on the topic of imagining teaching and learning at a Jesuit liberal arts college in the 21st century. Their charge was, if you like, to reflect on both the how and the why of an education of the type we offer uniquely here at Holy Cross. Our three other panelists are experienced university and college presidents whom Father Burroughs invited to respond to the faculty members' remarks and to offer their own observations on the theme of the day. Once all six of the panelists have spoken, we will be able to engage in a broader discussion, which will be moderated by Amy Wolfson, Professor of Psychology and Associate Dean for Faculty Development. To get us started, then, I invite Father Burroughs to the podium to introduce his guests on the panel. Father Burroughs.
Thank you, Tim, for your very kind words, and more than words are the constant support and encouragement that you've given me since I've been here. I must admit, though, that I was a bit of a distraction when you were speaking a few minutes ago. It was that phrase, fabulously wealthy, that kind of caught my imagination, and all I could imagine was, how much should I ask for? When I was a young Jesuit, I always enjoyed bringing my brother Jesuits home to meet my family, sharing two of the most important communities of my life with each other was always a treasured blessing, especially watching how well they interacted. We are a rather verbal family, and that meshed very well with my Jesuit brothers. I feel a bit the same way this afternoon, bringing my new community here at Holy Cross together with old friends for spirited conversation. It's a joy to welcome them here today. And so I'd like to introduce to you three presidents, each a good friend, who are joining us in this conversation. Since their academic credentials are well described in the brochure that you've been handed, my remarks are going to be a bit more personal. Sister Janet Eisner of the Sisters of Notre Dame served as a board member at the Board of Trustees here for several years. When I joined the board 5 years ago, we were both members of the Academic Affairs Committee, and that continued for 4 years until her term ended. As a fellow academic and as a president of a Catholic liberal arts college, Janet always understood the issues intuitively, and typically she let others discuss them first so that the points which needed clarification had understanding across the board. But I always knew that at some point, Janet was going to ask a question or make a comment which would take the conversation to a new level. And we all waited for her intervention, knowing well that she would lead us to a critical juncture of understanding. Earlier this year, Janet called me one day to advise me of an issue that was brewing off our campus, which might be of a concern to me. And once again, she helped me to think about the issue from a new lens, which I deeply appreciated. I am pleased that Janet is here with us today. With her understanding of higher education issues of the liberal arts and Catholic and mission-oriented perspective, and as someone who also knows the College of the Holy Cross very well. Janet Eisner has always impressed me as a woman with a critical mind and a great spirit. And I think we'd all have to admit that having served 33 years as the most successful college president at Emmanuel College in Boston, she has earned the right to speak and reflect with us today about the liberal arts. I first met Nathan Hatch about 20 years ago. His wife, Julie, who's here present, and her parents own a cabin on Priest Lake, Idaho. And my dear friends, Jim and Jane Pugel from Seattle, and their large extended family have the cabin next door. Over the past 20 years, I've probably spent part of my summer vacation there 15 times, and through the Pugels came to know the extended Gregg family very well and their son-in-law, Nat. Now, when I first knew him, he was a faculty member and then later provost at Notre Dame. We collaborated on a project together years ago when I first arrived at Georgetown. And then after his move to Wake Forest, where his chief of staff happens to be Mary Pugel, daughter of Jim and Jane Pugel, I have been a frequent guest and visitor at Nat and Julie's home many times. In fact, I've spent 6 of the last 7 Thanksgivings there in their dining room table. So with summers at Priest Lake and Thanksgivings and actually even 2 Christmas Eve dinners at their home in Winston-Salem, we have cemented a great friendship. In the earlier days of our friendship, we constantly talked about issues in higher education. But recently that took a shift, and now our perspective is a tad different because Nat has been very generous with me and Julie as well in reflecting on the role of a president and the implications on that on personal and professional realms. In fact, it was just 6 weeks ago that we were all at the lake together, sitting on your mother's porch, Julie, and having a 2-hour conversation about higher education leadership. And finally, I interviewed for my previous position at Georgetown in the winter of 2002, in fact, in the middle of a snowstorm. And one of the first persons I met was Dan Porterfield, who was then the vice president for strategic development. An interesting title for a man who has a PhD in English literature with a focus on the literature of social justice. Now, as it turned out, after I was hired, Dan's office was right above my office. And like me and his wife, Karen, and their 3 daughters, we all lived on campus. For about 7 years, on most Tuesday mornings, Dan and I and several other Georgetown vice presidents and senior colleagues met for 90 minutes every week to discuss a wide variety of issues which affect students' lives and how we as a university might engage them. It was a very important group of colleagues, and I think we were important for President Jack DeJoya as well when we were consulted on many significant issues affecting the lives and the reality of our community. Living on campus and seeing Dan and Karen's 3 daughters grow up there, seeing them at Mass on Sunday in the chapel, occasionally watching those 3 little girls playing on the lawn amidst a whole crowd of college students was always a welcome change and a joyous opportunity. Dan was appointed the president of Franklin and Marshall about a year before I was appointed the president of the College of the Holy Cross. He knows Jesuit higher education inside and out as an alum of 2 Jesuit institutions and as one who has made the 19th annotation version of the spiritual exercises and is a real champion of students and their needs at every institution where he has served. I am very pleased to share my friends with my new family here at Holy Cross, and I'm confident that you are soon going to understand why I invited them to join in this important conversation. Thank you.
Good afternoon. It is my pleasant duty to introduce to you the three Holy Cross faculty members who will begin our discussion. As you can see from their brief biographical sketches in the brochure you were handed when you came in, all three of them are accomplished scholars. In addition, each of them has been closely involved in a number of different activities that are at the core of the Holy Cross mission and identity. All of them are leaders in their departments, and they represent, as a group, the breadth of the Holy Cross academic community. Rob Balin from biology represents the sciences. Erica Fisher, who we are proud to call one of our own graduates, represents the social sciences in education. And Jonathan Mulrooney in English represents the humanities. So with no further ado, I am very happy to introduce to you the first of the three, Rob.
Thank you all very much. I reflected on this speech while I was at this summer's Collegium event, which was an ideal venue for considering ideas that would be meaningful to discuss during the celebration of the inauguration of the newest president at Holy Cross, Father Phil Burrows. For those of you who don't know, Collegium is an event that's held each summer that calls together faculty from colleges and universities across the nation to, amongst other things, reflect on the goals and purposes of Catholic higher education and to discuss the missions of these institutions, and basically why do they exist. The inauguration and installation of a new college president is an important time in defining the mission, identity, and purpose of any institution, as well as an important time to think about the future of that institution. So my frame of mind at Collegium was a fine match for planning my words for today. I'm a biochemist by training, and I teach in the biology department here at Holy Cross, and so as such, much of my viewpoint is from that of the natural sciences. And it's from that viewpoint that I want to speak about the importance of the natural sciences to a liberal arts institution, and also the importance of the liberal arts to the study of the natural sciences. In our modern world, filled with both huge advances in medical science as well as important issues like global climate change, the natural sciences are in no way separate from the mainstream of the world. As such, it's essential that liberal arts students, regardless of their major, are taught to understand the natural sciences and the scientific method as part of their education so that they can engage with advancements in science and scientific concepts in an intelligent way and not be like some people in the world these days who see science as something that's inherently wrong or dangerous or not to be trusted. I find it quite worrisome when I hear of laws and policies being formed in Washington and in state and local governments that purposely ignore data that's been collected using scientific approaches. Often this seems to happen because the data would lead to a loss of profits by a corporation or force an inconvenient lifestyle change for some people. The scientific approach does not allow us to pick and choose just the data we want to use to support the ideas and concepts we like. Instead, when applied properly, the scientific method provides an unbiased and a non-opinionated way to make fact-based decisions. As such, when students outside the natural sciences are educated to truly engage with scientific principles, as well as the methodology of the natural sciences, they actually understand the scientific school of thought and what it has to offer the world, especially as a way of approaching and making rational decisions about how to solve problems. This empowers them to become effective lawmakers, economists, and business people who, when faced with scientific data in their day-to-day work, will not shun it because they feel that they cannot understand it or the methods that are used to collect it. In a similar way, a liberal arts college is an ideal place for students in the natural sciences to be educated as an undergraduate. Here they are taught to be thinkers in the natural science fields, but also thinkers who can engage with more than just science, who can be eloquent in spoken and written word, an essential ability as they move into the world and have an increased responsibility to engage not only other scientists, but much more importantly, those not trained in the natural sciences. Part of the challenge we seem to face in the world right now relates to the fact that there seems to be an ever-increasing divide between those who look towards scientific information to help solve world problems and others who want to ignore a scientific approach or only pick and choose scientific findings if they support the ideas that they already hold. In addition, people of some religious backgrounds, as well as some scientists, continue to push forward the idea that religion and science are inherently opposed to each other. As a Jesuit Catholic liberal arts college, Holy Cross is well positioned to work towards mending these divides. Well-trained natural scientists with the ability to understand schools of thought outside the sciences, such as philosophy, ethics, and religion, have the unique ability to bring together the people of the world who tend to cling to a singular branch of thought or reasoning as having all the answers, whether these one-track thinkers are from a religious, scientific persuasion, or some other area of thought. Catholic Jesuit liberal arts institutions like Holy Cross are some of the only places where this type of academic education is obtainable. The degrees our natural science students work for and earn allow them to enter the work world as well-trained scientists to be excellent candidates for graduate or professional schools. In these roles after graduation, they could work as well-respected scientists while also carrying forward the broad and interconnected education they engaged in while students of the liberal arts. It is our students who can move on to bridge the divides that exist both because of scientists that reject all other modes of thought and because of those outside the sciences that reject and even fear the sciences. Unfortunately, it's individuals who reject other modes of thought that are often people who won't openly listen to anyone outside of their own educational background. For example, plainly, there are scientists in the world who will only seriously listen to other scientists. Our students have the potential to be the scientists who are respected in their field and thereby listened to and understood, but who also understand theology, ethics, and philosophy, and could bring those schools of thought to the discussion as well. In truth, the natural sciences are intertwined in the daily life of all of us, and an integrated study of the natural sciences is an essential part of a liberal arts education, both for the future chemist and the future economist, as we move forward to face the challenges of the world. With these ideas in mind, I make a call for a continuing commitment to educating students majoring in the natural sciences as liberal arts students, even as medical schools and other science-related professional organizations make calls for additional specific courses that could make us consider eroding the traditional liberal arts core. In addition, and potentially more importantly, I call for increased efforts to ensure that non-science major students partake in rigorous education in the natural sciences, including the development of the understanding of the practice of science. As educators at Holy Cross, we cannot allow students to graduate from this fine college without a deep understanding of both scientific principles as well as the methodology of the natural sciences. We need to ensure that no student with a Holy Cross degree feels that science is outside of their grasp, or that properly conducted scientific studies can be ignored if it makes things more convenient by doing so. I conclude my comments here, and I very much thank the College of the Holy Cross for giving me the chance to reflect on these ideas as we welcome Father Burroughs to our campus community and celebrate his inauguration as the 32nd president of our college. Thank you.
As an alumna and now a faculty member, I have had the distinct opportunity to see the college grow and transform over the past 20 years. The inauguration of Father Philip Burroughs brings yet another opportunity for dynamic change to this college. As I reflected on the speech, I thought of this institution's past, present, and future, as well as the future of Jesuit liberal arts in higher education. My doctoral degree is in social justice education, with a specialization in counseling and marginalized populations in school settings. So my perspective today is grounded in both my education here at Holy Cross as an undergrad, as well as my role now as a faculty member. This past spring, I had the opportunity to participate in the Ignatian Pilgrimage. The pilgrimage, for those of you who don't know, was designed to give faculty a better understanding of the Jesuit tradition and to follow St. Ignatius' journey in both Spain and Italy. It was during this time that I began to think about my remarks for today. Leading up to the pilgrimage, we had the opportunity to explore readings related to the Jesuits and St. Ignatius. Through the readings and the lived experience, several reoccurring themes emerged: the concepts of social justice, imagination, and adaptability. I found that there is a strong connection between these themes and to the future of Jesuit liberal arts education. Within my field, the field of education as a whole, the talking point of the past several years has been preparing students to possess 21st century skills, simply meaning what skills do our current students need to acquire during their educational experience to be productive citizens in a global society. While often viewed as empty rhetoric, The three primary skills mentioned are cognitive, interpersonal, and intrapersonal abilities. The students must have a solid academic foundation and be able to manipulate information, be capable of communicating effectively both written and in written and oral form, work well with others, and have a sense of resiliency and adaptability. No small task to accomplish in 4 years. The fundamental underlying principle of 21st century skills is really the concept of transfer. Transfer is the ability to apply pre-existing knowledge to new situations. Policymakers on the K-12 level and educators are in a quandary as to how to effectively teach the skill of transfer to their students. I would argue that the model for effectively teaching these 21st century skills rests in a liberal arts education. The skills outlined are skills the College of the Holy Cross has been instilling and reinforcing in undergraduates since 1843. It is a delicate balance, cultivating students' 21st century skills, as well as ensuring that the mission of Jesuit education endures for a lifetime, not simply for the 4 years students are on this campus. We as faculty have the opportunity to act as guides. In the Jesuit tradition, we have the ability to model fearless yet thoughtful behavior through our teaching and curricular choices. Our choices should be meaningful and connect to the skill set necessary to succeed in our constantly shifting environment. To stay relevant, we must carefully analyze how we live the mission of men and women for and with others. An education without justice, without meaning, and ethics will create citizens incapable of functioning in our ever-changing world. However, the question we must continue to ask ourselves is, what does social justice look like in a meaningful way? This institution, like many, has adopted a strong focus on community-based learning. It is a trend that holds value, yet also holds inherent dangers if not carefully implemented. I will offer the case of the Education Department, our small little corner of this campus. In this department, our students last year participated in nearly 6,000 hours of community-based learning. From student teaching to therapeutic interventions in schools, the hours our students spend in the community hold value for both partners. However, we continuously reflect on the academic rigor and curricular connections that these placements bring, as well as the skills students acquire to allow for that future transfer. This reflection and constant adaptation is necessary in order for students to engage with the meaning behind the hours. It is the only way that they'll carry their commitment beyond the gates of Holy Cross. To have students perform countless hours of community-based learning without a curricular tie places Holy Cross on the precipice of becoming simply a social service agency. Reflection, adaptation, and restraint are also necessary as we send our students into the community, often to work with our most vulnerable populations. The potential to do more harm than good without proper supervision and curricular background is a danger that must be continuously monitored. We as an institution must hold true to both the educational and the social justice mission of our college. The tradition of adaptability found within the Jesuit community will be the cornerstone to the success of Jesuit liberal arts education. As the K-12 American education system struggles to adequately prepare our students for higher education, and new populations of students are entering college for the first time, our ability to adapt to the increased academic, personal, and social needs of our students will be paramount. The future of Jesuit liberal arts rests on maintaining what we do well, providing a rigorous and solid academic foundation, small classes that allow for growth in communication skills and critical engagement in curriculum material, and those small classes that also encourage strong interpersonal relationships between faculty and students. Continuing to provide students in every discipline with key concepts, procedures, and methodologies that can be transferred to other disciplines and future careers will be instrumental to the future success of our institution as well as the students. Much of my current work focuses on the importance of interpersonal relationships in education and the impact on achievement. On the K-12 level, the push towards testing has removed the ability to nurture relationships within the classroom as well as critical thinking skills. In higher education, the push towards technology and online courses has severely reduced the interpersonal aspect of education. The relationships students form with faculty are key to the commitment students have with an institution beyond graduation as well as to their academic success. For institutions that rely heavily on alumni giving, these relationships equate to the very well-being of the institution as a whole and its longevity. These relationships are under stress due to the frenetic pace that both faculty and students are living. As an alum, it is apparent to me that relationships have changed over the past 20 years. I would suggest suffered. The pilgrimage that I mentioned at the beginning of my talk allows for small numbers of faculty to build community. However, I would urge the administration to continue to explore effective mechanisms that allow faculty time and space, not only to form much-needed relationships with students, but with their colleagues as well. We must balance curricular decisions, maintenance of interpersonal relationships, all while maintaining a concerted effort to meet the needs of our changing student population. As to ignore the shift in societal demographics will certainly equate to failure and stands in direct contradiction to the Jesuit liberal arts tradition. This year, we celebrate 40 years of Women on the Hill, a historic change in this institution, one that presented challenges yet altered the institution for the better. The current demographic shift should be embraced as well. The diversity of thought that students of different genders, ethnicities, socioeconomic status, and sexual orientation bring to the classroom, that they bring to the classroom, enrich the educational experience for all. Unfortunately, the trend in underpreparedness of many students will continue, and colleges must adapt by providing more resources to incoming students that continue through the first 2 years. Summer orientation and preparation programs designed for first-generation and Alana students should therefore be offered to all students. It has become abundantly clear that students from all backgrounds have the potential to arrive at our gates underprepared. This year marks the first year that incoming freshmen will be unable to pre-declare a major. This decision allows students to truly explore the curriculum and experience the liberal arts. The College of the Holy Cross displayed thoughtful fearlessness by delaying the declaration of majors for incoming students. It is certainly not easy to fly in the face of trends and the pre-professionalization of 17-year-olds. However, as we know, U.S. Department of Labor statistics suggest that students may change employment upwards of a dozen times after graduation. Thus, the commitment to providing a true liberal arts education, a broad and deep academic foundation that allows for that critical transfer of valuable knowledge and skills, is a commitment from which liberal arts education and Holy Cross cannot waver. It is on this note that I will conclude my remarks. I would also like to thank the College of the Holy Cross for allowing me to share my thoughts on Jesuit liberal arts education, and I join my colleagues and welcome Father Philip Burrows to campus.
It is a gift to be here today in this house of stone and light and a single butterfly flying around to welcome this remarkable man to our community. As I've already come to know him, he brings tremendous grace and eloquence and hope to the college, and I think he's already demonstrated that. So I thank Dean Wolfson and Father Harmon for the invitation to speak to you today. I apologize for my voice. My six-year-old has gifted me with her sore throat, so I'll do my best to sound for you. This June, I found myself at the University of Virginia during the controversy over the ousting of President Teresa Sullivan. The reasons behind Sullivan's removal by the UVA Board of Visitors are still not entirely clear, but it is fair to say that her vision of the university's direction differed markedly from that of the board, and that the contours of the disagreement were shaped by the distinct institutional logics of academia and those of the business world. I mention the UVA case not to revisit the controversy in a detailed way, but to suggest that the incident illustrates the crossroads at which North American higher education now stands. In as short a time as the next decade, the leaders of our institutions will have irrevocable decisions to make about what our colleges and universities will become over the next century, and about how those institutions will shape American public, not to mention private, life. Whether we are to be merely the specialized training ground of the professional classes, or whether we will adhere to the humanist mission that prompted the founding of so many places of higher learning, remains to be seen. Holy Cross matters in all of this because it holds a unique position in American higher education. As the only exclusively undergraduate Jesuit school in the nation, we have more than any other American college a direct genealogical line back to the teaching institutions the early Jesuits founded. These were schools, colleges before they were universities, John O'Malley has shown us, committed to the education of the whole person, and thus to the integration of intellectual rigor and professional formation. Their pedagogy was informed by the humanisms of the great medieval universities. But the Ratio Studiorum also resisted the instrumental training to which such institutions were becoming increasingly beholden. 5 centuries later, this tension persists at Holy Cross. Indeed, to the degree we capitulate to the professionalism that defines our own historical moment, to precisely that degree, we risk losing sight of the responsibilities that our Jesuit heritage entails upon us. This capitulation takes several forms, but manifests itself most notably in the college's changing institutional organization and in the way that that organization influences our students' daily lives. Holy Cross is subject to many of the same pressures as UVA, as Harvard, as any other college, to advance our institution in an increasingly competitive marketplace, to offer myriad extracurricular activities and first-rate facilities, to provide students with marketable skills, and to do this all while keeping costs affordable. Our particular response to these pressures, to meet them all while emphasizing social justice and the undergraduate experience, is laudable. In fact, it has distinguished us from places that have embraced online learning, part-time coursework, and vocational training, all potentially praiseworthy initiatives, but for us, simply not what we do. We have maintained on the whole an identity as a liberal arts college. But what might be called the Holy Cross response has, in its own way, begun to hinder our ability to bring into the world the kind of thought, imagination, and ethical action so desperately needed now. The problem of which I speak is our adoption of a professionalized way of life that, in the interests of complete education, threatens to obscure the centrality of academics at the college. This may seem like a strange claim to make. After all, we pride ourselves on our commitment to the liberal arts and sciences. But the matter is more than one of curriculum or of publicly stated mission. Look at any student's calendar, or, for that matter, look at the orientation schedule with which we met our first-year students, and you will find it filled to capacity. They run, literally, from activity to function to class to meeting to event to library to sleep sometimes, and so on again in the daily round, all while building credentials, acquiring skills, developing resumes. Rather than integration, rather than cura personalis, the result of all this busyness, is a compartmentalization of time and of experience, a separation of academic work from the athletic, from the social, from the spiritual. To be sure, there is real learning going on at Holy Cross. But when the academic becomes merely one of so many entries in the student datebook, or for that matter, the faculty datebook, rather than a presiding institutional concern, we have begun to lose sight of who we are and of why we are here. We have created this reality in part because we seek to respond to student needs and to the needs of a world rife with human suffering. We wish for our students to encounter what Father Kolvenbach called famously the gritty reality of the human condition, to put their academic endeavors in a larger context, to develop a well-educated solidarity. What I fear, though, is that in that effort, we have begun to stray from a fundamental commitment to the life of the mind, to the well-educated dimension of Father Kolvenbach's phrase. Our students, like students at most places, simply do not have time to devote themselves fully to serious and transformative study, to the habits of reading, reflection, argument, and discernment, that used to be the sine qua non of the college experience. If we have done well at Holy Cross, and I think we have done exceedingly well at Holy Cross, at living out the Jesuit credo of faith that does justice, we could do better, I think, at maintaining our connection to the intellectual apostolate of the Society of Jesus. And this means modeling for students how an Ignatian commitment to justice can only emerge from the studied interior transformation of a self living out that other dimension of Ignatius's great design, faith seeking understanding, following Anselm and others. What I am calling for is a Holy Cross that clearly values, above all else and in every aspect of our institutional structures and practices, the ability to provide for students a 4-year experience of the life of the mind, and an integrated sense of how that life, lived in the context of the Jesuit Catholic traditions of intellectual inquiry, Ignatian spirituality, and Christian love, can transform them, can, under the sign of the cross, transform a world encrusted with tears. I propose that the singular challenge facing Holy Cross as we embark upon a new era of possibility, marked by the wonderful event of Father President Burroughs' inauguration, is to reclaim for ourselves and for our students the spaces of serious reading and thought that have been stolen from them all their lives by the noise of the contemporary world, and that we have stolen from ourselves by over-administering our days, our weeks, our semesters in the service of professional accomplishment, and a word that has become recently the near enemy of thought, in the service of excellence. Concretely, this means articulating and enacting at the very top of the administration a commitment to the academic endeavor as the center and circumference of all that we do here. More specifically, led by our new president, we must first reinvigorate the role of the faculty in the highest levels of institutional governance. Second, these are just suggestions. Second, include a critical mass of intellectuals and scholar teachers on our board. Third, foster dialogue between faculty and those trustees. Fourth, hire and train more administrators who have a deep understanding of our classroom culture. And fifth, provide a reimagined curriculum that is at once more flexible and more rigorous than our current system of common area requirements. And these beginning steps must all be directed toward developing on the whole a way of proceeding that quiets the days of our students, even as we set their minds and hearts on fire. This is, I believe, our call over the coming decade at Holy Cross, a call that simply cannot go unanswered if we are to honor the mission of those men who founded a society so audacious as to call itself the Companions of Christ, nor if we are to continue the work of those fellow travelers with the Jesuits who have for 170 years come to teach and learn in this place, on this hill, at this college that could bear no bolder name.
Well, first, thank you for inviting me to be a respondent to the faculty symposium as part of the inauguration celebration. And thank you, faculty, for such compelling presentations of your perspective on teaching and learning at a Jesuit liberal arts college, as you imagined the future of Holy Cross. You stimulated me to consider three themes: the integration of knowledge and evolution, teaching and learning in a plugged-in, always-on society, and the contemplative campus. Rob Bellin addressed, as you just heard, the importance of natural sciences in liberal arts education, refuting the notion that religion and science are inherently opposed to each other, recognizing instead the value of interconnected education. These values are deeply rooted in the basic tenets of liberal arts education and emphasized in Catholic colleges, particularly, which claim as their framework the principles in John Henry Newman's idea of the university. Newman says the Catholic university is a place of concourse where students come for every kind of knowledge, which teaches all branches of knowledge where theology, seen as a science, holds an important place. It's a place where the intellect may safely range and speculate, sure to find its judge in the tribunal of truth. Familiar quotes. Ilya Delio, a theologian and scientist at Woodstock Center in Georgetown, writes about evolution. Catholic universities need an invigoration of the Catholic imagination for which dialogue between science and religion is a rich source. Theology cannot continue to develop apart from 21st century cosmology, ecology, nor can science substitute for religion. She stresses the need to support the mutual enrichment and develop collaborative structures of interaction between science and religion, bringing faculty, students, and professionals together across disciplines in order to evolve toward a more sustainable future. The discoveries made by science change how we tell the story of creation. We find new metaphors. Teilhard de Chardin claimed that evolution is no longer a mere hypothesis, but dominates the whole of our experience. God is conceivable only within the context of evolution. God is within the universe, the cosmos, not necessarily only out there. Chardin, a French Jesuit paleontologist and geologist, was known as a philosopher of evolution after his death in 1955. I think he's the influence behind so much of the thought and analysis of today's scientists and theologians. And he notes at the end, to comment further on Rob's point, after the close of two centuries of passionate struggles, neither science nor faith has succeeded in discrediting its adversary. On the contrary, it becomes obvious that neither can develop normally without the other, and the reason is simple. The same life animates both. Neither in its impetus nor its achievement can science go to its limit without becoming tinged with mysticism and charged with faith. End of quote. Science takes us beyond Galileo's telescope to the Hubble, and now maybe to Curiosity. It's coupled with biomedical research, and this leads science to raise new questions about the beginning and the ending of life, and Catholic liberal arts colleges are ideal places for this dialogue between religion and science to take place. Erica Fisher speaks of the importance of skills for the 21st century to include the cognitive and interpersonal abilities and the need for a sense of resiliency and adaptability. She notes, "This reflection and constant adaptation is necessary in order for students to engage with the meaning behind the hours they are accumulating and to carry out the commitment of social justice beyond the gates of Holy Cross to the vulnerable populations." Now, these are clear challenges. Her perspective is deeply rooted in Jesuit educational commitment to the education of the whole person and the care of the person. The questions remain: how do colleges achieve a greater sense of community and shared purpose? What does it mean to be authentic, both in the classroom and with colleagues? And how can we help our students achieve a greater sense of meaning and purpose in their academic and personal lives? So these are the values. So the challenge gets greater when we look at faculty at Holy Cross and other liberal arts colleges. How do they adapt the teaching and learning experience to the most plugged-in, always-on generation that the world has ever known? The headlines in the Chronicle of Higher Education, the Times, and this morning's Moody's headlines say, Harvard and MIT put $60 million to free online courses. Come the revolution, says Stanford. Massive open online courses known as MOOCs. Colleges may never be the same. And as I said this morning, Moody's Investing Service calls MOOCs a pivotal development, a win for big brand name universities. Now, I can imagine and know that most people, certainly people in this room, believe that this will not, in fact, replace the on-campus experience for very many sound reasons. But we will, however, be influenced and are challenged by these developments. So I'd like to go back to the importance of emotion, cognition, and learning and see them as linked, as Erica has suggested. Some exciting transitions are taking place in colleges today. The learning management systems in our colleges continue to provide new possibilities for student engagement. Just one example. The flipped classroom, which is a movement away from the traditional classroom lecture, which I and all faculty members have always loved. Flipping the classroom inverts the expectations in the traditional classroom, including interactive engagement where students learn from others and teach others within the class while the teacher is present. non-interactive aspects of class are pushed outside the classroom by having streaming lectures done by the same faculty member online. It can be recorded, pre-recorded, and delivered along with other readings so that the class time is spent in the interactive engagement and the didactic is spent off campus. Now, I know that some of those would be some of the discussions going on here as well, but it clearly says that the human contact, the faculty contact, is essential. And I have to say, I am learning this from our faculty almost every week, as well as with the leadership of our own academic vice president. So this is one way, I think, that we begin to look at the key role that's always been there of the influencer of the teacher with different ways of working with the plugged-in generation, many others. Jonathan Mulrooney proposes that Holy Cross needs to reclaim for ourselves and our students the spaces of serious reading and thought that have been stolen from our lives and develop a way of proceeding that quiets the days of our students and ourselves, even as we set our students' minds and hearts on fire. That is clearly an ongoing challenge. And I notice lately as well that students, too, are looking not only for the space, but the time. Here, Holy Cross has the places, but like all of us, we need to find the time. I'm wondering if it would be a good idea to discuss what a contemplative campus would look like, drawing maybe on some of the work that's done by the faculty just up the road at Amherst College and the study of the contemplative mind in higher education. There are ways to engage ourselves and our students in the spiritual, creative, the consciousness-aware aspects of education, giving students an experience of the contemplative. There is such a rich tradition of the contemplative in the Jesuit tradition, as well as contemplatives in action. And it seems to me that it's important to open those opportunities for reflection and prayer, not just in retreats and times of reflection, but with faculty and conversations with faculty. And that may be a different way of reaching and engaging students. Clearly, the educational mission of Holy Cross is primary. Your care for students motivates you. That's very evident in the comments and the wonderful papers that you presented. But I also invite you at Holy Cross to consider another role. This may be one of the few places, a Catholic college, where true scholarship on the critical and ethical issues of our time can be studied, analyzed, debated, reflected upon in a free and open manner. This conversation, by its very nature, would be an amazing gift to the church and to society. Now, I noticed in your most recent magazine that the alumni of Holy Cross voted that the number one moment in the whole history of Holy Cross was January of 1971 and the decision to go co-ed. Now, I want to assure you that at that time, I was a young director of admissions at a women's college in Boston, and I also recognized that decision as momentous. Buses to Worcester for mixers stopped. 40 years of women graduates is truly something to accomplish, to recognize. And you celebrate this accomplishment in so many of your periodicals. And I just wanted to comment on what a great gift that is as well to the life of higher education, to the life of the world. So congratulations. Holy Cross has a great heritage that's very much in your minds at this time of inauguration of Father Burroughs. And I'm thinking back to May of 2012 when Father John Brooks was recognized with the publication of a book on what a visionary work he had done in changing history for the 20 black men. And instead, he dismissed the praise and gave all the praise to them. I think we're also recognizing in another recent publication from Holy Cross the deep and amazing commitment of Father Michael McFarland in providing, giving his legacy to the college. So with that, there is so much on which to build and so much for Father Burroughs to take Holy Cross forward into the 21st century with his amazing will and commitment to mission. So thank you and congratulations, Father Burroughs.
Good afternoon. I'm deeply grateful for this opportunity to be at Holy Cross. This is a really auspicious occasion. Holy Cross has a very distinguished history as a Jesuit liberal arts college, and the inauguration of Father Phil Burroughs is a wonderful time to celebrate, to reflect, and to renew the distinct calling of this place. Let me congratulate Father Phil, a longtime friend and esteemed colleague, and all of you at Holy Cross. I have every confidence that the years ahead will be bright indeed. I'm most grateful to Professors Fisher, Balin, and Mulrooney for their very thoughtful reflections about teaching and learning at this place. I would like to respond by using a certain principle, the Jesuit principle of contemplatives in action. That sort of irony that the Ignatian charism has always said, we don't just retreat from the world in order to think and contemplate, nor do we just give ourselves to the world and apply acts of mercy and service. It is to do both. Jesuits believe in the importance of the life of the mind. And from the 16th century on until our own day, Teilhard de Chardin was mentioned, but Karl Rahner, Bernard Lonergan, John Courtney Murray, and many others, this powerful life of the mind. And Jesuits have believed in the redemptive power of education in building schools, colleges, universities. Their impulse has been to engage the world with serious thought and reflection. That, too, seems to be the burden of Jonathan's paper. He calls for Holy Cross to reclaim for ourselves and our students the spaces of serious reading and thought that have been stolen from our lives by the noise of the contemporary world. He calls for a return to the spirit of Ratio Studiorum in the face of an education that seems increasingly instrumental and professionalized. He would like us to get off the what David Brooks calls the giant achievatron. I could not agree more with his advice, but I would like to emphasize how difficult that is in the culture in which we live, how difficult it is for students to be reflective and deliberative, given the great allure of our generation to connect. The total number of mobile phones in the world has gone from 500 million to about 5 billion today. A study of the Pew Research Center tells us that half of American teenagers send 50 or more text messages a day, and one-third send more than 100 a day. 54% of these students said they text their friends at least once a day, but only a third said they talk to their friends person to person. We have this allure about being constantly in a state of connection. But what it means is we are in a constant state of interruption. It's a wonderful book by William Powers called Hamlet's Blackberry, a practical philosophy of building a good life in the digital age, which I think lays out these issues increasingly. But it's a question which we all face, and I'm not sure what the answer is. We can't retreat to an earlier age. But it is, Gail Collins said recently, I think it's hard to be great without the ability to concentrate. The more distractions we've built into our culture, the harder it is to develop serious thinkers and planners. And over the last 50 years, our span of attention has collapsed to that of a hyperactive gnat. That's the challenge which we face. And I appreciate the compelling way that you set that forth. Having agreed with that point, I would like to ask one modest suggestion, giving a framework of a place like Holy Cross to be contemplatives in action. I would suggest rather than seeing humanist and liberal arts education in tension with matters of being a profession, that we need to see them as both and. We need our students to learn for its own sake, to learn to be more reflective, to expand their interior life, to learn what the false gods of the modern world are: money, fame, influence, looks. Yet at the same time, most of the students of Holy Cross will become professional leaders: doctors, lawyers, investment bankers, educators, business leaders. Liberal arts college may once have been able to focus solely on their own internal curriculum and expect that most of their graduates could find professional employment. But that is no longer the case. Today we do not serve students well if we don't, with our left hand, get them ready for the professional world while with the right hand focusing on learning for its own sake. I think we do have to do both, even given the tensions in doing so. Rob Balin speaks to us from his perspective as a biochemist and argues rightly that we need more students who understand science, both those who major in it and all of our students. The question I would like to raise, it's a puzzle why the so-called STEM disciplines, science, technology, engineering, math, attract so few American students. This is the age of Steve Jobs, Michael Zuckerberg, Groupon, and Amazon, where the future and the good jobs are in those areas. Yet of all industrial nations, the United States is dead last in the percent of students who pursue the STEM areas. The problem is even more acute for women and persons of color. My challenge is actually to scientists: why this is so, and how do you begin to correct the problem? I think it's in great measure it's a cultural problem. Often it is how I think science and math are taught. I can remember a dean at Notre Dame once telling me this: when students are doing poorly in the humanities, the typical professor thinks it's their fault. But in science and engineering, when students do poorly, it is often blamed largely on the student. Defective preparation, lack of orientation and commitment. It is as if there's a certain bar, and if you don't get with the program, you shouldn't be studying the discipline. So it seems to the big question, and I think this extends down into primary and secondary education as well, is how do we make science more compelling, more attractive, more accessible? There are wonderful models of this. What Freeman Hrabowski has done at University of Maryland, Baltimore County is terrific. My challenge is how do we attract and keep more students in those disciplines? The theme I would like to take up in Erica Fisher's remarks is already been mentioned, but it's the importance of interpersonal relationships in education. We do live in the age of the MOOCs, massive online classes. I want to emphasize the importance of the bond between teacher and pupil. Interesting article by Adam Falk, the new president of Dartmouth, a few weeks ago in the Wall Street Journal, entitled "In Defense of the Living, Breathing Professor." He pointed to Dartmouth's study that suggests that what really matters in higher education is a set of the abilities to write effectively, argue persuasively, solve problems, and remain adaptive. And he said their studies show that increase in those skills correlates precisely with the amount of personal contact between a professor and a student. Not virtual connectivity, but interaction with real, live human beings. If we are committed, in fact, to the ideal that a mind is not a bucket to fill, but a fire to light, then we must continue that ancient tradition of teachers engaging students. That deeply personal quality of engagement has been at the heart of the Jesuit tradition, the cure of persons, the cure of souls, and must remain a high priority at a place such as this. Teaching is a magnificent calling, because the high and holy calling of the faculty is to educate whole persons, to inspire them to do well and to do good. If there's one thing that I would hope for Holy Cross in the coming years under the wide guidance of President Phil Burrows, it is that teachers would gain new insight into the power and privilege of teaching students, that they would be contemplatives in action in their ability to engage students in ways that shape their lives so that they go out from this place to be worthy citizens and leaders. Thank you.
Thank you, President Hatch, Sister Janet. It's great to meet you up on stage. Distinguished faculty, loved reading those papers. Clearly they were not last-minute writing jobs like mine. And thank you for putting all the time into it. And it's the conversation will continue back in Lancaster, some of the ideas that you expressed. It's pretty cool to be here and see Phil in this setting. I guess I'm not going to get to see you get married, so this is going to have to be the best I can do. There's more than a few Georgetown friends around here. I'm just going to do some Hoya pride and could ask the Hoyas in the crowd to raise your hands for a second. Yeah. So take that in. Take that in. It's a long way up. We're really proud of number 32. It's so great to be with Phil and to reflect a little bit about what Phil meant to Georgetown, as I just make my remarks a bit informally. And one thing was that Phil inhabited a new role. There hadn't been a vice president of mission and ministry in Georgetown's, whatever it was, 210 years or something when he came on board history. So he had to invent the role, and he invented it through a combination of listening and acting, probably much like he's been as president, listening and acting, really getting to know the community, seeing where his contribution could be made, perhaps looking to where he had the answer to a problem, or even the answer to a problem that people hadn't yet identified as a problem. And he did that so beautifully at Georgetown. And one of the things that Phil did that's worth just noting here for a moment, because at first I didn't get its importance for me, or in general for anybody, was he focused on the development within the faculty and the staff and senior officers of a deeper understanding of Jesuit identity. And it wasn't that I didn't value that. I did a lot. I just thought people knew what they were doing and they felt like they had a command of it all and that we have so many things to do to save the world that, you know, gathering up ourselves, didn't we need to be gathering up our students more? And then I watched Phil in partnership with a few other colleagues develop a 19th annotation that probably, I don't know, 100 people have done at least in the years since he developed it, including me, and many in this room. And, you know, you just realize the power of concentrating talented, busy professionals, whatever our jobs are, on replenishing our wells, to quote Phil. And that kind of vision was one that Georgetown didn't have before he came. He had to teach us to want it. And then when he left Georgetown, it stayed behind to keep developing. And that's great leadership. So I want to recognize that and thank you for doing that there. And I bet you there's things that are going to be here in 25 years that were grown the same way with such subtlety. To me, the question that we're asking here, we as anybody who loves Jesuit education, or who loves Holy Cross in particular, is what does it mean in 2012 and beyond for Holy Cross to be an authentically Jesuit and Catholic liberal arts college? And that's a pretty tricky question. I don't think you can answer it so much as live it and work through over time what the questions mean. And one reason why is because what does it mean to be Jesuit changes? And what does it mean to be Catholic changes? While these are great traditions that go back centuries, traditions change. They evolve. We help evolve them. And so we have to be attentive to the dynamics and rhythms of change within these deep traditions. Similarly, the idea of a liberal arts college in America is changing ever so slightly. We're creating the change. We may create the change in a way that's tremendously empowering and responding to the threat of the MOOC. But it will change, and so it's not just a matter of finding the right answer, but living the question. To me, living the question means looking out, too, not just looking in. That's very Jesuit. You know, the John Courtney Murray quote about the mission of the Jesuits is to be on the borderlands, where the church meets the world and the world meets the church, to be out, looking out. What are the needs that we're called to respond to? How do we express our identity and know our identity still better, and know our faith still better by listening to and responding to the needs of others, of strangers? And so here, what are the needs of students in 2012 and beyond? What are the needs of faculty and staff in 2012 and beyond? What are the needs of your alumni who exist in a continuing developmental relationship with their alma mater and are constantly looking back for more, for that authenticity of purpose? What are the needs of the community of Worcester in which God placed Holy Cross? And what are the needs of the communities and communities and communities, the world beyond that, for the education you provide, for the convening that you do, for the knowledge that you create? And that authenticity isn't just the Jesuit and Catholic part, it's the liberal arts college part too. This is a knowledge creating entity. Part of its mission is the new ideas, the new questions that we make here. And so, and what does it mean to make new ideas in 2012? And what ideas are needed now? And that's where these three talks came in. I really loved it. Because Professor Bellin was talking about the needs for science literacy and for science to be humanist and for the country to take facts seriously and to care about evidence and scientific method. Professor Fisher was talking about this idea of the transfer of knowledge and transfer of experience, so crucial to creating civilization. You've got to transfer to the younger generation. And Professor Mulrooney was talking about recentering ourselves on the intellectual life and the academic purposes and always holding that center right and square in our vision. And so you have, you know, in the faculty, you have these expressions of idea about what does it mean to be authentically Jesuit, Catholic, liberal arts college called Holy Cross. What does it mean to be authentic? And their answers are reminding us about the centrality of the academic rigor that defines the place. We can't be scared off from that. That's crucial. Double down, triple down on the academic quality and experience being strong. But I also heard in their reflections these other strains. They're almost like if you made it a triangle, there'd be a couple things holding it up at the bottom. And to me, what I heard from each of you in your different voices was that tremendous respect for the Jesuit Catholic tradition. It's a foundation on which the school exists. And then also respect for community on the one hand and the individual on the other, the dignity and eminence of individual need, which is very much a part of the liberal arts tradition too, and not just the Jesuit and Catholic tradition. So I really wish you well in living the questions of what does it mean to be Holy Cross, to be authentic to what you are. You have a president who values that conversation intrinsically, not just instrumentally to get to the answer, but as a way of knowing ourselves still better, reinvigorating our commitment and our sense of who we are, our love for one another. Who cares if this is the Catholic Amherst? Who cares? Let them worry about being the secular Holy Cross. So I wish you best wishes, and thank you so much to all of you for inviting me today.
First of all, I'd like to extend my own personal welcome to President Burroughs. Welcome. And thank you for giving the faculty the opportunity to speak as part of the inauguration festivities. And thank you to my colleagues who have joined us all here this afternoon. And of course, thank you to Erica Fisher, Jonathan Mulrooney, and Rob Bellin for their inspiring and insightful comments. And thank you to our guest respondents for your really heartfelt and provocative and timely responses. So thank you all for being here for this special inaugural faculty symposium. As my colleague Dean Austin explained in his opening remarks, I'm going to begin by posing a few questions, possibly only one question in the interest of time, and then I'm going to turn things over to
all of you to join in a short discussion with our panelists about their remarks and about the questions and thoughts they've proposed this afternoon. Of course, you know, I would have loved to ask lots of questions myself. So first of all, would any of you like to ask each other a question or add an additional comment now that you've heard from each other, which they had not done previously? So we'll start with that. You'll see there are microphones that you can use, and I'll let them respond a little bit. And then I'm going to say time out. They can't talk anymore. And I'm going to turn things over to all of you, and let me just say that there is a microphone up here. When you do come up with your questions, please, of course, speak into the microphone. But first of all, to our panelists.
Well, I'll start. Professor Fisher, you're doing some tremendous work in education, and I was really intrigued to hear that you've been very interested about the emotional and needs of kids in underserved and marginalized communities. And I'm sure that Holy Cross contributed to your development of that commitment since you went here. So I guess I would ask you, and I love, by the way you argued that community-based learning, which is a huge good done well, can be done wrong, too, if it's not academic enough and serious enough. And it was just so inspiring. So I guess I wanted to ask you, as somebody who graduated from Holy Cross, what did you get from your undergraduate experience, and has that helped to make you what you are right now?
That's a tough question. Everyone knows, I joke that I don't bleed purple necessarily yet, but it's kind of lavender. So I would say Holy Cross shaped me in many ways. One of the most pivotal experiences I had here was a senior internship in which I worked with battered women. And my students know the story that actually upon graduation, I took the police exam. I was going to be a law enforcement agent, and because I thought I could save the world through that action. But really, my senior year experience working with battered women, helping them get restraining orders, seeing social justice in practice and action, the key to that experience was that I had a senior seminar associated with it, I had supervision, I had guidance, and I also had 4 years of education in psych and soc to have that skill. I also had a mentor at the courthouse when I was there. And so I feel Holy Cross gave me the opportunity to work with vulnerable populations as a college student, which shaped the rest of my life. However, it was done in a very, very thoughtful way, and it's something that I take very seriously with working with vulnerable populations. Populations today.
Rob, do you think I'm off base in my statement about the teaching of science?
No, not at all. I mean, the fact that, you know, we see students come into science courses and then we see numbers drop through the years, right? There's a lot that don't finish the start in the first place, and not as many that probably entered as could. And it's a, you know, it's a big question that many of us in the disciplines consider. You know, what is it that makes it seem daunting? Is it the quantitative nature? Is it people scared of math, or is it something? I mean, I think it's probably bigger than that. But some days I do think that it's the fear of that quantitative nature of things that keeps people away from it. But it is an interesting thing in the way that you brought up the possibility or this idea that, you know, we kind of say if you can't make the bar, then maybe you shouldn't keep going in that area. And it does seem that, you know, at times that almost the training in science is almost a hazing experience, right? That you got to kind of take your knocks over and over and over, and if you can't make it. And I happily see that that's changing. I think that this isn't something that is the way we do all science education. And I don't mean that anyone is enforcing that's how it should be. It's just kind of how things often were done. And I think a lot of things that have changed, if you look at, you know, especially the teaching of physics, there's been so much work at the college level of effective physics teaching has basically said what we shouldn't do is stand in the front of the room, give a lecture, and say if you can't get it, well, that's your problem, right? We have to do things for more engaged, you know, classroom education and things like that. And so I think that some of what we do in the way we teach science can keep people in the sciences. Now, the question, why don't people come in the first place, is another one. I mean, there's been a lot of discussions amongst national academies. Do we train too many people, actually, in PhDs in sciences? Because there aren't really actually that many jobs in those areas. And I think sometimes people see that there may be a future in sciences they don't know really how to get there. And is it actually through a degree in the sciences or not? So these are big questions. I'm not giving at all good answers to them, but I do think that you actually pose you're right. This is a big issue in STEM. And if you look at graduate programs across the United States, most of them are maybe, half international students. And so we're training a lot of PhDs. Many of them are not coming out of American universities. And so it's an interesting point at the undergrad level.
Any of you have a question for our presidents that have joined us this afternoon?
No. They were all very clear.
I'm just going to pose one question before one more question, I guess I lied, that hasn't come up that I'd like to make sure comes up before I turn things over to all of you in the little time we have left. I had a whole introduction to this question, which I will not read to you. But I guess one question that I have to everyone is, and really to everyone, is that at this juncture in our history, both Holy Cross's history as well as the history in terms of higher education, is a Jesuit, broad, rigorous, educational and intellectual experience preparing students for whatever they might choose to do after Holy Cross? Or dare I ask, something that I know has been talked about on Nathan Hatch's campus, what would you say that we at Holy Cross, a Jesuit liberal arts college, should be doing differently to prepare students for the demands of the 21st century, emerging, noisy, perhaps scary world that is in our headlines these days? Anyone want to respond to that? Dare I ask you? Jonathan?
You used the word scary, and I think often the way that our institutions proceed these days is out of fear of the blackening cloud of financial distress, fear of, legitimate things. But there is that thing that the first thing that Pope John Paul said to the world, and he was quoting somebody else, do not be afraid. And I think that what we need to do is envision as imaginatively and as thoroughly as we can, trained as most of us are in the liberal arts or within a liberal arts context, what it is that we need to do, and then find a way to do that rather than say what's possible. And so, it's not an easy answer. It's not to be naive about, we can do whatever we want. Of course, there are financial realities, there are political realities, and those change, by the moment. But at the same time, I think there has been a kind of, a conscription of how we think about what these institutions can do in the world. And we're so on the defensive, amidst all of these political and corporate conversations. And it's great to see people like Dr. Falk and others finally, I think this was occasioned in part by what happened at the University of Virginia this summer, standing up and saying, it's not just about, liberal arts education, really, it is really marketable. It is really marketable. But it's also to say, even more importantly and more fundamentally, we're not here to teach you how to make a living. We're here to teach you how to live. The living will follow. It really will. I believe that. And to come back to what Dr. Hatch said, I don't think it's it is a both and, but I see the way of professional training through the life of the mind. If you can think imaginatively, if you have skills that come with that, then all this will follow after. So that's a broad philosophical response, but I think that there are real concrete steps informed by that way of thinking that can shape who we are as an institution.
It seems to me that the very answer that Erica gave earlier can be multiplied in so many ways. And in the graduates of Holy Cross, the recent graduates I'm talking about now, their experience here, whether it was in an internship or in immersion experience, has made them able to live the education that they have been exposed to here. So if there's anything that emphasizes that experiential along with a rigorous academic experience, it seems to me that's the greatest gift that can be given that does work. It does provide them to engage, to work in the world.
Thank you. So I certainly would like to open things up for additional questions. You probably want to use the microphone. I'm told I... I don't know if everyone heard the question. I'm not going to give the whole introduction, but how are we at a Jesuit liberal arts college like Holy Cross engaging the world?
I would say two things to that. First, there are myriad ways that we are reaching out into the community, and I think it's already been a hallmark of Father Barros's tenure here to reinvigorate that commitment to Worcester and the broader church and the world. But I also think that there's a false dichotomy there between what happens in the classroom and what happens in the real world. I think when my students are reading Homer, they are very much engaged with the real world. They are becoming forces of imaginative good, learning, whether it be Dostoevsky, Homer, whether they be, you know, hanging out with Higgs boson or whomever, you know, in the sciences. It's not just, you know, I don't want to privilege the humanities too much, but that sense of here's the world and here's the college campus seems to me a kind of dichotomy. The life of the mind is life, and I think our students actually are deeply hungry for that, and they recognize that the 50 texts a day are not getting it done for them in what life can be. They want to have conversations that are real conversations. They want to be in the room with other people and other bodies, not just screens. And so what are we doing in the world? Yes, we're reaching out. Yes, we're socially active. But what we're doing in the world is thinking, reading. You know, what John Adams said, let us dare to think, read, speak, write. That's what we're here to do.
Speak up, though, so everyone can hear you. Thank you. If you can, thank you.
I have a question that emanates from a concept that some of you said, which was fear. And I'm taken by the fact that the presentation about, in a sense, a dichotomy between what we learn while we are students and then what we are doing for not just the real world, but for preparation for the real world of the 21st century. I'm not sure I can define the real world, but I would like to know something about the concept of lifelong learning, because I see that in this real world that we all inhabit, there seems to be a closing of mind on the part of people who have completed their education, whatever the level is. And it seems to me that we have a commitment to lifelong learning, at least in principle, but I don't know how it transmits itself to people who perhaps are not well educated in science to understand something about how it affects public policy, who are not well enough immersed in the social sciences to understand the benefits and the dangers of dealing with people, and who don't understand the depth of language and literature and the history of culture. How do we move from what we teach at our institutions to making certain that those who have graduated from our institutions continue to learn and to value it as a lifelong discipline and part of living?
That's a big question.
Rob, can you give the gist of it a little bit? I'm not sure. I'm going to ask on our last couple of questions, if you could please come to the microphone because the back of the room cannot hear you, and I won't begin to try to quote what you've just said.
I think to some degree, I mean, to kind of bring down to a kernel of idea, how can we create a situation where the students who graduate from our colleges, you know, embrace lifelong learning, continue to seek out new knowledge, and don't just end their idea and say, I am now educated, I now go on with what I have, but instead keep going forward and embracing new ideas and thinking. Is that a fair way to and I think it's a great question, and it's one that was something I was thinking a lot about when I ended up focusing a lot on the sciences in my talk, because the sciences especially seem to be an area, but probably lots of areas, where people think they so often say, and we always cringe in the sciences, people say, I'm not a science person, right? And we'll hear that in our science classes, but you hear that of people who are outside of college, done with college, and part of my end comments of saying, you know, we shouldn't graduate students that can make that statement and say that they can't understand science. But we can just so easily broaden that to almost any other area in the liberal arts. And I think that part of what we need to do, and I don't know exactly how we do it, but is empower students who are going to not be students once they graduate, but they really should still have that mentality that they don't feel that there are areas that they can't approach or shouldn't approach or didn't try to understand. And how we do that, I don't know. I mean, one of the things in the sciences I think that we strive for but don't always do the best at is making sure students understand not just the historical lessons in science, meaning what are the facts we already know, but what are the practices or principles or ideas, and this is kind of why I focus on the scientific method, because that's how you look forward, rather than saying, what have we already done? And I think this is the important thing if you think about lifelong learning, is giving people the tools that they can use once they've left. And normally those aren't just what has other people done, but how do we approach a problem? How do we think about an idea so that we can approach new things as they come up?
I would also just add that it's what I said in my speech about modeling a fearless behavior and modeling learning. I often discuss with my students that this isn't 4 years of playing dress up for life. This is life. It's not dress up. It's not playtime. You need to learn the skills and you need to continue to learn, and that we can't model stagnation as faculty members. And I think it goes into critical thinking, creative thinking, telling students that they can challenge us and they should bring new knowledge to the classroom and continue to learn and to continue to grow, and that if we model that behavior, they'll also adapt that behavior as well.
I mean, I think even more fundamentally, what we're about here is not just the communication of techne, it's not just the communication of information, it is challenging and asking students to rethink human identity and to rethink what it means to be in the world, that it is a question of how you move through the world and not just that you are a static thing which can take in this information and then process it and use it out in the world. And Teilhard's come up a couple times. You know, he said, I believe that every man makes his own soul throughout all his earthly days. That's what we want to communicate to our students, whether it be as a scientist, whether it be as a Jesuit, whether it be as a father, as a mother, as a teacher, whatever. It is that act, that process of living, that way of proceeding, to use that Jesuit term, that we most, you know, they're going to forget what year Keats was born in. I know they're going to forget it as soon as the test is over, right? But if they learn the lessons about what he can possibly mean to someone who reads him, and then they go back to him and read him again, and they live in a world in which identity is not a static thing, the world's going to be a better place.
I'm going to take one last question because I'm told that there are reception that we would like to all get to. We promise not to keep you much past five, but I see there's one more question, and then I'm going to turn things over to my colleague, Professor Godsheng.
Can you hear me?
Can you come to the mic? Or turn so people can hear you in the back, because otherwise they can't. Thank you.
I would like to suggest that we might at least think privately about this symposium with a somewhat different spin. Imagining teaching and learning at a Jesuit liberal arts college in the 21st century without Jesuits. And I say that because earlier this week, the Jesuits in Washington just closed one of their very, very few parishes. On this occasion, a news article in the Washington Post, which pointed out, among other things, that the number of Jesuits at Georgetown has steadily declined. It's down to about 50% of what it was when I came to Georgetown. And of those Jesuits, about 50% are above the age of 70. So I have faith that the Jesuits will not become extinct. But I have to say, the statistics don't give me much confidence about that if I worry about statistics too much. And I think that's something we ought to contemplate here, because a great deal has been said about the importance of the Jesuit background and so forth, but nothing at all about the evaporation of the Jesuits.
It seems to me that the integration of the Jesuit mission is deeply rooted in Holy Cross and in many other Jesuit institutions and Jesuit ministries. And it's clear that this is in the hands of the graduates, it's in the hands of the co-workers, and I have great hope that the mission will continue at Catholic colleges, whether it's Jesuit or otherwise, in the hands of the current faculty and the graduates. And it's very strong here at Holy Cross, it seems to me, in terms of every person over there on the faculty has taken part in a particular program to understand it. So I think that's the hope and the trust that that we need to see that this tradition is going to continue and become richer, in fact, by those who are going to embrace it wholeheartedly. That's what I think.
And I think, indeed, you're right. I'll just say two words, since it's an issue that's near and dear to my heart, being a Jewish faculty member who knew nothing about Jesuit education until I arrived here 20 years ago. And absolutely, we are working hard to think about how faculty come to understand Jesuit education, the importance of Jesuit education, and what that means for our working with our students. So I think that's absolutely the case here at Holy Cross. I'm going to turn things over to my colleague, Tom Godshang. Thank you very much.
We've had a lot of interesting ideas raised here. I would like to thank all of you for participating in this academic celebration of the beginning of Father Burroughs' tenure as our new president, and the continuation of having a Jesuit in that role as long as possible. I think we are all enjoying the benefits of. So I would like to invite everybody to adjourn to the reception, which will be in the science courtyard. You go back out the library and take a left. There will be refreshments, and we can continue this discussion there. Thank you.